Thanks, everyone, again, for coming out. I also want to begin by acknowledging the territories, unceded territories of the Coast Salish people that were gathered on here today, and also honoring the struggles of Indigenous people, not only here on Turtle Island, but around the world that have been struggling against the system, political and economic, that we're discussing here today. I was loosely going to talk about environment and trade today, but I've kind of sort of thought about talking more. I mean, I will talk about those things, but sort of framed my thoughts today around the idea of looking and understanding how the 1% maintain power. And to actually think about that a bit in the context of trade agreements and what's happening to the environment and everything that's already been talked about today. And when we think about that, the one thing that's constantly been talked about so far in the Occupy movement and many other places is this idea of economic power. And we really need to understand that issue as well. But we can't talk about economic power without talking about political power. There's an economic system that we're fighting against, but there's also a political system that we're fighting against, and we need to understand how the two work together and really combat them both at the same time. The economic system's fairly clear. A lot of people have already talked about it. You've probably heard more about this than anything else. The concentration of economic power is increasing. The reality is that those that already have money or have the ability to make more money and have a lot more make more money much easier than the people that don't have money. Capitalism is obviously a curse on the environment. The very, very simple logic of the fact that you can't have infinite growth, which capitalism requires, on a finite planet. It's just impossible. You're ultimately not, that's not a sustainable relationship. So we understand that this is an issue, but we haven't really examined what are the political foundations and the political systems, some of what actually Glenn talked about now, that actually underpin this system and support capitalism in its quest to dominate the world. So let's think about this. I'm going to begin first talking about trade agreements, because I think trade agreements, if we actually start looking at them again, and a lot of people actually talked about trade agreements historically to really link up what's happening today in terms of economic power and political power and what happened historically in terms of colonization. And just to remember, you know, when the British East India Company went to India, they were going there for what in their own literature was called free trade. So free trade isn't something new, right? This was the process of colonization that began many, many years ago. So let's look at some of what's happened in trade history post, you know, post-NAFTA in Canada and generally around the world. Essentially, if we look at it, trade agreements are aimed to remove the power of people and communities to make decisions that would undermine the interests of corporations and other institutions that represent the global elite. That's essentially what trade agreements do, right? And we've seen this happen all over the world. Post-NAFTA, communities in Mexico were told that you don't have a choice. You know, you need to allow foreign direct investment and have these communities displaced off their land for mining projects and other projects. Many of those mining companies based right here in Vancouver. We see this happening, and we now understand the sort of weird thing that we had about national sovereignty and like nation states being the victims of trade agreements. We know that that's not the case. The real issue is that the elite of all these nation states that engage in trade agreements are really the beneficiaries, and communities and people are the people that suffer. It's not the nation states that suffer. It's the people within these communities and within communities that really suffer. And we're seeing this continue right now with all of the agreements that Canada's signing. We've heard a lot about the European Union, but Canada right now is signing trade agreements with India, Peru, Colombia. And who is really benefiting from these? The mining companies of Canada, the oil companies of Canada. Enbridge Pipelines was one of the key backers of the Colombia Free Trade Agreement that was signed recently in the last year. So it's not really this idea that, you know, Canada's always the victim or Colombia's always the victim. There's people in both of these countries that are benefiting. But the one thing that we can see, and you know, and the reason why we need to look at these trade agreements and how they impact people is that although we might be the 99% and although we might be communities that are impacted, we're all impacted differently. Indigenous people and people of color around the world, the global south more generally, because of the concentration of economic power and colonial history that created that concentration, are impacted, those communities are impacted much more severely than many of the communities here. I mean, we are talking about the growing gap, but we need to understand the context of the growing gap when you go to the global south and what that gap looks like compared to here. Or when you go to a reservation in Canada and look at what the gap is there in terms of the level of poverty and the level of poverty that exists generally within North America and in Canada. So what else is happening with NAFTA now, right? So after NAFTA was implemented, what we basically had was that the corporate citizen was free to travel around the world. The problem was is that you had all these quote-unquote non-citizens showing up at the border, right? So there was this kind of unique situation where corporations were basically displacing people, people off of their lands, indigenous people, peasants, poor people, that basically were able to sustain themselves without the investment of corporate power. And they, being displaced, were either ending up in the slums of major cities in the global south or trying to come to North America to better themselves or have some sort of economic security. So what's the response of the people, the 1%, and the political power? Is to not necessarily support these people or actually give them status or give them the right to earn a living where they're migrating and where the resources and the riches of the lands they used to live on is migrating. But the solution is to further exploit them. So you have a system where you have the Security and Prosperity Agreement that was signed between Canada and the U.S. and Mexico in 2005 to complement NAFTA to basically take advantage of this system by creating and the expansion of the guest worker programs that people have already referenced already. Because you have this exploitable labor market, you don't just want them to sort of like sit there and not work for you. You can exploit that labor market both in Mexico, but you can also exploit it when it crosses the border here by not giving them status. These people aren't able to unionize. People aren't getting the basic benefits that most workers have in this country. And there's a really colonial and racist dynamic that is basically used to justify this exploitation and that they're different workers and workers here deserve those rights, but these workers do not. So the other thing that happened with the SPP is that how was it signed? It was signed basically between, there was no discussion in our communities about the SPP. I mean, some of us, like, you know, organizations like the Council of Canadians, known as Legal, many community group organizations did try to talk about it, raised the issue. But really, decisions were being made by a body of about 30 corporations from Mexico, U.S., and Canada that sat down with the quote-unquote representative leaders of these countries and made the decisions about how these agreements are going to be passed. And again, it was just another example about how you're concentrating political power at the same time as you're implementing economic power, in that you're taking away power from communities and basically the rights of communities and concentrating them further and further up these institutions that support the 1%. Another great example of it is these new comprehensive agreements that are being implemented now. So the European agreement is one that people have probably heard a lot about, but there's also one that's being negotiated with Israel, an apartheid state that has had many issues that people have been trying to raise. But Canada, becoming its best friend, is implementing a comprehensive trade agreement and probably will be the first one that's implemented with Israel. But what do these comprehensive agreements do? The key thing about these agreements compared to the past trade agreements like NAFTA is that when NAFTA was signed, basically they were taking away decision-making power from the provinces, for example, right? So NAFTA was signed and the Quebec government wanted to have a pesticides ban against Dow Chemicals basically had a Chapter 11 challenge to say that you can't do this under NAFTA. And so that ability for Quebec to make that decision was taken away by the Canadian government signing this agreement. Now, with these comprehensive agreements, what they want to do is that they want to have both the Canadian government and the provincial government sign these agreements with Europe and Israel. And basically what that will do is that it will take decision-making power not only away from the provinces, but it will also take it away from municipalities. So right now, municipal decisions that people are making technically don't come under NAFTA. But with these new comprehensive agreements, if you decide that you want to keep your water public, if you want to have local production of food, if you want to have local procurement, all of these decisions are going to be taken away from you. And we've seen these examples already happening, not just with trade agreements, but generally. When we've seen the IPP issue, the independent power projects all around the province, something like 49 municipalities voted against having them developed in Vancouver Island, and the BC government basically passed Bill 30 to prevent those municipalities from having any say, because you don't want people locally to have decision-making power. Same thing basically happened. I mean, an example that which was victorious was just recently the most one of the most right-wing ridings in all of the in the entire country, Abbotsford, when they were asked about privatizing or keeping public their water system, they voted 74% in opposition to privatizing it. So when you're making decisions locally, people actually understand that, okay, it's the things that we actually tangibly use and take care of that are going to be impacted, and they make somewhat smarter decisions most of the time, not always. But the key here is that when we realize that there's this concentration of power and you basically have, you know, concentration from provincial power to federal power to international power and now municipal power all the way up, the key here is that when we talk about supporting indigenous sovereignty, this is exactly what colonization did to these communities, was took away their sovereign right and their self-determination to make decisions for themselves. And that's what we need to understand is that this process that is now impacting the communities that aren't just indigenous was basically constructed, and you know, the racist dynamic of colonization that was used was imposed on these communities much more early and way before we're actually seeing this impact here today. So indigenous self-determination, when we talk about these things and when Glenn talks about us standing with these communities and supporting them in their fight for self-determination, it isn't a radical concept. Sometimes we on the left think that this is a radical fringe movement that's supporting these ideas. The radical concept is actually allowing people that live 100 kilometers away from your communities to make decisions for you. That's the radicalness of like the right that we actually have to understand. So it's not really anything major for us to say that we can stand with indigenous communities and fight for self-determination, for their self-determination and sovereignty, and think about us doing the same thing. And these systems aren't new. The same thing applies for when we're talking about fighting the temporary foreign worker program. The foreign worker program isn't anything different than the head tax and the exclusion act that the Chinese community had received an apology for from the federal government, where basically they were exploitable labor that weren't able to get status, yet we have the exact same system being imposed here today for like communities from all over the world, whether it's Filipino living caregiver programs or it's Mexican communities working on the farms here in BC and in Canada. So, I mean, it's really about the right for people to say no, right? It's a right for people to have self-determination in their own communities. Right now, in BC, we have communities that are saying no already. Fish Lake, this prosperity mine, the Sokotin have already said no. Yet they're being forced through, they're still being forced through a federal process, an illegitimate process that doesn't have jurisdiction on unceded territories, even though they've already said no. They're still being forced through their process. The Enbridge pipeline, countless indigenous communities have already said no, and non-indigenous communities have said no. But we're still going through the process that supports the 1% and these pipeline companies. So We need to reimagine and be able to challenge the racist and colonial systems that were established before and recognize them for what they are today and not be blind to challenging the political system while we're challenging the economic system. So how do we engage? We should engage in a manner that we talk about self-determination. Let's stop appealing to the systems, but let's start challenging their jurisdiction in our communities. Yeah. It will be the best thing to do in terms of what we do for ourselves is to challenge your jurisdiction in terms of being in solidarity with indigenous communities. Let's talk about things like Solidarity City and Sanctuary City that like organizations like No One Is Legal are working on around the country in terms of challenging the right for these federal quote-unquote agencies to come into our communities and label people non-status and deport them and arrest them. That kind of challenge to their jurisdiction and their authority. Let's challenge the jurisdiction of the rubber stamping environmental assessment processes that are basically allowing for the destruction of the area around the tar sands, the communities around the tar sands, and all around BC. And so when we think about the Occupy movement, it also relates here as well. Let's stop fighting for permits and let's start fighting for our freedom. Let's stop actually thinking about permits as being the way that we're going to fight this thing, right? Let's actually start challenging the jurisdiction of these governments. And in the end, if we're fighting for self-determination, we're ultimately not dancing to the tune of their system. So finally, I know I'm almost like, I'm going to just take like another minute just to like make this, wrap this up a bit. tangible things that we can do. So that's more theoretically what we can do, tangible things we can do. Communities fighting Fish Lake, the Enbridge pipeline, the Kinder Morgan pipeline, the Ruddock Creek proposal in Squamish territory, the Raven coal mine on Vancouver Island. We need to be in solidarity with them. We need to fight for the self-determination of these communities, and the Occupy movement has to stand together with these communities as well. The second thing. There's a call for a shutdown of the ports on the west coast of North America from Occupy Oakland. Yeah. This is a part of their system. This is the way they, this is the system that they both use, the infrastructure that they use to further colonization and the infrastructure that they use to accumulate their wealth. Shutting down this system on one day will be a huge statement to the 1% about the people resisting back against them. So I'm really hoping the Occupy Vancouver movement calls for this action, but I hope that all of the movements and the struggles of the organizations that are represented here today that we're a part of are going to endorse that call and actively mobilize to actually shut down both ports, the Delta port where they want to propose a free trade zone, and also the Vancouver port where they, which is closer to home here. Really quickly, the free trade zone is the one way where the corporations are actually fighting for their self-determination and autonomy. They're declaring a zone where they get to set labor standards, they get to set the corporate agenda, they get to set the tax rate, possibly a 0% tax rate, in an area at the Delta port, a free trade zone. There's information at the back if you want to see it. So if they're fighting for their self-determination, we have to fight even harder for self-determination here. And the last thing I just want to plug is that we need to continue this conversation. Many of the people that are here today, there's a conference that's going to happen in the beginning of January that's called The Tragedy of the Market, From Crisis to Commons. And this is the beginning of a conversation. We're going to be fighting in the streets, but we need to keep talking, and that's going to be another opportunity to do it. So I urge you guys to register for that as well. Thank you.